Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. So tonight I'd like to talk about intention. And intention is an impulse in the mind that precedes any thought, speech or action. And we very often aren't aware of the intention as something that happens before we speak, before we act, because we just act on automatic pilot. So part of our practice, especially in meditation and in mindfulness and awareness practice, is to start to become aware of our intentions. And to start to see where these intentions come from and how they give rise to action and whether those intentions are actually carried through. So we may, as we start to observe the mind, become aware of intentions as a phrase, a set of words in the mind. I want to do that, I'm going to do this, or I should do this. But as we go to deeper levels, we'll experience that this intention is experienced directly as simply an impulse, an impulsion, like an energy wave. And why it's important to become aware of intention is so we can start to direct our speech and our behaviour, as well as our thinking, consciously in the direction that we want our life to go. And so that we can also see that very often when we say, oh, I didn't mean to do that, or I wasn't going to talk about this, but I'll talk about it anyway, that actually there was a subtle intention in the mind which we were unaware of, which takes us sometimes into dangerous territory. And then after we find ourselves in dangerous territory, we think, how did that happen? Once we become more familiar with these intentions as they arise, we'll become more skillful at refraining from following those impulses which take us into dangerous territory. The other reason for talking about intention and starting to become aware of it consciously is that very often we have an intention to produce something in our life, to do something, and between the time or the moment of that intention and when we can actually realize the goal of that intention, it takes time. Takes maybe persistence. We get sidetracked. We don't actually head directly to the realization of our intention. And sometimes we can get very disappointed because our intention isn't being realized. We can feel a failure, or we can think that something's gone wrong. We might get discouraged. And so it's very important to see that intention and the realization of our intention isn't necessarily immediate, and it may take a somewhat circuitous route to get to where we want to go, but that just making the journey is part of that whole process. The journey may be different or longer than we thought at the beginning, and there's nothing wrong with that. It also helps us to understand better what meditation is about. Because very often we assume that meditation is meant to be peaceful, calm, and give rise to happiness. And we meditate because our intention is to be happy. And then when we actually do the practice, we find we very often find the mind full of things that don't lead to happiness, or that we don't feel comfortable with, or that aren't calming. And so we think something is wrong with our meditation. And so if we think that meditation is only going to be pleasant, then our intention to meditate to be happy, which is based on wrong understanding, will maybe lead to us giving up meditation because we're not getting the result that we think we should get. And our wrong understanding in the first place gives rise to a misguided intention. I'm meditating to be happy, and it should happen immediately. That's our expectation. But in fact, the meditation includes much more than just the immediate results of happiness. We have to actually work on the meditation to get the results of happiness. So our original intention to meditate to become happy, to become peaceful, we need to understand as just a starting point. And then how we actually accomplish that through our practice is going to take time and perseverance, and perhaps bring us in contact with experiences, the way of our mind, that we weren't expecting. So the reason for giving this talk arose because of someone telling me a story which is very familiar. I found out as I've related it up at the monastery, many people have experienced the same thing. And it's all to do with this intention of meditating to be happy. And this person was telling me that they'd been a teacher for many years, and they'd also been doing meditation. And they had in mind the idea that when they retired from teaching, that they would be able to give more time to their meditation and their spiritual practice. And they knew that that was beneficial. So they were very inspired to organize their life so that they could have more time for their meditation. And so after they retired and their children were off their hands, they downsized from their house, got a flat that was just suitable for themselves, and they even made a special room in their apartment just for meditation. Everything was set up so nicely. And so a couple of years after their retirement, they were ready for giving more time to their meditation. But they found, to their surprise, that they couldn't bear to go into their meditation room. They couldn't stand meditating. And they said to me, "I can even walk right over my meditation cushion and I'm still not inspired to sit down on the cushion. What's happening? What's gone wrong? After all the work of getting everything just right, with the intention of giving more time to my spiritual practices." So when we talked about their situation and what their expectations were about meditation, it was clear that there was this very narrow understanding of what meditation should be, that it should be immediately pleasant, peaceful, and calming. Whereas, in fact, having been busy working at a stressful occupation, raising a family, retiring, downsizing, doing all the things necessary to reach this situation of good conditions externally, the person had spent 20 odd years being very busy mentally. And now that all that activity had ceased, their mind was still very busy, but it was also taking the opportunity to process many of the experiences and emotions that hadn't been processed during that 20-odd years of busyness, 20-odd years of stressful teaching. And that was what was happening when they would sit down to meditate. All this stuff would come up and they would think there's something wrong, shouldn't be happening like that. And of course it was unpleasant, and so they didn't wish to do their meditation. So there was an aversion to the meditation. And they said they hadn't really realized how much stuff they were carrying around until they went to the local swimming pool one day. And there they saw a teacher with a class of children. And the teacher was expending so much energy trying to just get the kids to be quiet and to take in the lesson and to keep them safe, do all the things that teachers have to do, especially in a situation like a swimming pool. And the kids were doing all the things that the kids normally do, not anything outrageous, but just having fun, just being kids, playing around, not listening, all the things that usually go on. And this retired teacher said that it made her feel so uncomfortable, almost sick, that she had to leave the swimming pool and go outside, just because it reminded her of all the times she'd been at the front of a class trying to keep them in check, trying to teach them the lesson that was supposed to be taught, trying to meet all of the obligations that she had to meet during the course of her day. And she realized, because of that incident, just how much of that a backlog of things she'd been carrying with her and which needed to be dealt with. And the place to deal with them was in meditation, but how to deal with them when they were so unpleasant. So the original intention to set up all of the external conditions to give the best possibility for doing spiritual practices, that intention was still there, and it was being played out in a way that she hadn't expected. Just having the outer conditions wasn't producing the result that she expected. The result that she expected was already based on wrong understanding, that just by having the outer conditions and just by having the intention to practice, that everything would calm down. In fact, there's a lot of work in this meditation that is about dealing with the unpleasant things that come up as memories, as experiences, both as thoughts and also as emotions which we feel within the body, which we feel again and again, that need to be processed again and again. This is what meditation is about. It's not about suppressing those things. It's not about putting a lid on them. It's about bringing them into our conscious awareness so that we really know what the mind contains, and so we can also see what things we need to work with so that we can understand them, so that we can allow them to wear themselves out and cease, and what things in our mind are useful and helpful that we need to make grow. So this person, in order to deal with the things that she had to process, she realized for herself, I need to do loving kindness meditation. I understand that, but how to do it? Very often when we think about loving kindness meditation, we approach it from just the wrong understanding that meditation on loving kindness is going to automatically solve our problems, that somehow we're going to put a lid on things by covering them up with loving kindness. But in fact, as we go deeper into the work that we need to do in the mind, true loving kindness provides us with an environment in which we can bear to face the things which we can't face right now. The things that are difficult, the things that are painful, the things that are confusing, things that are hurtful, things that we're not comfortable with. Loving kindness ultimately gives us a mind which is capable of bearing with those things and allowing them to come up. Not to push them away, but to give them some space and to hear what they've got to tell us. This is what loving kindness ultimately allows the mind to do. So for this person who had the intention of working with her stuff and wanting to be able to produce a mind that was leading towards benefit for herself, how could she produce loving kindness to create this environment to do the work? And so, speaking with her, as I often do with people, it became clear that there was some way which she could use because of her experience as a teacher. And her example is just an example. Each of us has to find out the way that we can generate loving feelings. We can get in touch with that love that already exists in our heart. How we can do that in the context of our own life, using our own experiences and the things that really work for us. So for her, she said that she felt as a teacher, over the course of her life as a teacher, she had given a little bit of herself to every student. And she said sometimes it really was beneficial and obviously beneficial. Sometimes it didn't seem to do much. This kid was all right without any great assistance. And then sometimes there were the students that you did everything you could to help, but you didn't really feel that you'd made much difference. So this idea of having given a little bit of herself to each of her many students. And I asked her if she could remember the students that she taught, and she said, oh yes, many, many of them. Sometimes I was teaching them for the whole year, sometimes I just had them for special classes, but many of them I could remember quite clearly. So I suggested that one way of finding that loving kindness in her heart for herself as well as for the students was to visualize these students one by one standing in front of her in her meditation, seeing their face with a smile on it, and seeing them, each of them, holding a flower in their hand which they were offering to her. Not needing any words to say, but just an expression of their appreciation to her. And she said that she had even met some of her pupils years after she taught them, and they told her how they remembered what a wonderful teacher she was. And so she even had that image that she could call to mind. And so this kind of practice would be something that you would do again and again and again, setting up an environment for the loving feelings that are present both in your own heart and in the heart of the person that's offering the loving kindness to you, so that those loving feelings start to grow. And when you're doing a practice like this, as for this retired teacher, some of the memories that will be triggered by seeing that child and remembering when you taught them and what was the circumstances of the class at that time, Some of those memories may be even unpleasant, remembering some of the difficulties or some of the failures or something else that was going on at home at that time that made an extra stress in one's life. So it's not that this sort of meditation is going to take away the painful feelings, but it's going to reveal those painful feelings in a way that can be addressed and dealt with. Now, another way of working with allowing these feelings to come up in a manageable way is to, out of the meditation, cultivate the body-centered thinking that I was talking about in the meditation practice that we've done tonight. That is where we focus our awareness on the body, the physical body, in its activities and movements throughout the course of the day. We keep our attention with what we're doing while we're doing it. That body-centered thinking is always in the present moment. And it cuts through the tendency of the mind to run into memories, to dwell on negativities, to go over stuff again and again, to replay situations that have happened that never have any resolution. It just is a repeat of the same old thing again. If we can focus in the present moment and become skilled at that, we cut through all of that movement of the mind into dangerous territory. That movement and dwelling in things which are not happening in the moment, which have happened in the past, this dwelling in negativity continually leaks energy. It wastes energy, mental energy, which often triggers off physical feelings that are uncomfortable. We waste energy so that when we do try to do anything constructive with the stories of our life, whether it's in daily life or in meditation, that we feel overwhelmed. We feel we just can't do anything. We haven't got any energy to bring to the work that we need to do. Because we've been leaking the energy that we've got available through useless thinking. So this body-centered thinking is a way of conserving our mental energy and strength. And then if we are able to conserve our energy through our daily life, we can also then start to direct our attention to the pleasant feeling that arises when the mind and the body are one. Being able to keep our attention in the present automatically, naturally gives rise to a pleasant feeling. When our attention is focused on what is happening, physical activities right here, right now, when the mind is not wandering away. And then we start to become aware of that pleasant feeling and delight in that pleasant feeling, and that becomes a source of energy to the mind. Once we come in touch with this source of energy, we can start to appreciate it. It can be a springboard for us to cultivate gratitude for what we have right now in our life, before anything else that we might be working towards arrives. What we have right now is already a considerable amount of good fortune, which we fail to notice if our mind is constantly running into the past and dwelling on negativity. So keeping it in the present, giving it the chance to build up this pleasant feeling, and then using that as a springboard to appreciate what we have in the present moment. This is the way we strengthen the mind. We feed the mind what is useful, and we build up the ability of the mind to face the things which are unresolved, which are unprocessed. So actively cultivating loving kindness in the meditation together with our daily life practice makes it possible for us, when we do sit down to meditate, to do the work that we need to do. Now, from the point of view of the person, this person that I'm using as an example, the intention was to give more time to their spiritual practices. But if we define our spiritual practices very narrowly as just meditation, sitting on the cushion, then we can almost make it difficult to get started, because there will be this unpleasant feeling that's produced as the mind has got nothing else to deal with. It deals with all of that unresolved stuff. But if we broaden the scope of what we mean by our spiritual practices and see that it's not just what happens in meditation, but what we do with our mind throughout the course of our day, we can gradually build up the capacity of the mind to bear to come into meditation. So our intention is being fulfilled, even though our intention, which we thought was going to get us the result immediately, is actually bending because of the circumstances of our life. And this is one of the things that we need to be aware of with intention. This is an example I've given from this person's experience, but it points to the nature of intention itself. Intention, or sometimes it's called our will, we assume arises out of our free choice in this moment. But according to the Buddha's explanation of experience, intention and even our will doesn't arise out of our free choice. It's the sum total in this moment of all of the accumulated choices we've made in the past, all of the habit patterns that we've formed, all of the experiences that we've had, all of the ways in which we've actively cultivated the mind through wisdom. Our intention arises already as a result of previous causes and conditions. What we intend is already coloured. And once that intention arises, it is again coloured by what is going on in the present moment, the forces that are having some bearing on the present moment situation, even at the level of just thinking about what we're going to do. This is what we refer to as our intention gets bent. We have an intention to do a particular thing, but all of the other causes and conditions, like our habits, our usual way of doing things, the choices we've made before, the environment that we're in, the way that we're feeling that day at that moment, all of these things will determine, affect, whether that intention gets carried through and how it gets carried through. So in the example of this person who's retired from teaching, all of the many times that she went to work, even when she didn't feel like it, all the many times when she did the right thing because she had to, all of those experiences from the past have a bearing on the intention to go and sit and meditate. I should meditate because it's the right thing to do. I should meditate because it's a good thing to do. I should meditate because it will be helpful for me. All the times that she's been forced to do what was the good thing or the right thing or the best thing, and she didn't really feel like it. All of that is present in the moment of thinking, I should go and meditate. And so the original intention to make the spiritual life more important in her daily activities is still a valid intention, but it's bent by the experiences that she's had around doing what is good and beneficial and right. Even if it's a good thing to do, that is, will have beneficial results, it's bent or affected by all of those other experiences. Generally speaking, we're not aware of how our intention arises, already conditioned, and we're not aware of how our experiences, our conditioning, affect how the intention that we have will be lived out, will be realized. So one of the examples I've been giving to just see how this sort of thing happens is just an example of someone trying to live out an intention to do something simple like, I'm going to go to the beach. And you may get up early in the morning and decide that you're going to hop in the car and drive straight to the beach. That's the intention. But just as you're getting into the car, a whole lot of other people come along and hijack your intention. So someone says, oh, if you're going to the beach, you can drop me off at my friend's place on the way. Someone else says, oh, if you're going that way, you can take me to the office. If you're going that way, just drop me off at the corner so I can buy a paper. Oh, if you're going that to the beach, just drop me off at McDonald's. And so the original intention to go to the beach is hijacked by all of these other people, and you may still get to the beach eventually, but you go by a circuitous route, maybe not the one that you had chosen originally. So all of our intentions are like this. The intention to get a particular result is affected by all the things that come up to hijack us. The things that come up can be in our environment, something outside ourselves, like it's the wrong weather for doing the thing that we want. We have to postpone it, do it next week. Or it might be things that come up within us that make it impossible for us to realize our intention immediately. We might lose our confidence, for example. We might find that as we go about doing what needs to be done, that it takes more effort than we thought it would, and so we lose heart. This is the way our intention gets hijacked. Now, the spiritual practice that we do is to make us aware of all of these factors that are having a bearing on our life. And I've spoken to you previously about the fact that when we try to take up the meditation object and give our undivided attention to the meditation object, that many things will come between the knowing and the object. Our mind will be lost in thought, irritated by the sounds around us, maybe too worried about what's going on at work to pay attention to the meditation object. We start to see what's coming between us and the object that we're trying to watch. Gradually we see what our mind contains and what is going on in each moment of consciousness in our daily life. As we're doing what we think is one thing, lots of other mind moments are coming in between to colour our experience of that thing that we're doing. Now, it's the same with intention. the intention arises, and what comes between the intention and the realization of that intention is all the things that are in our mind and in our life coming between the realization and the intention, bending the intention away from what was our original goal. And in the practices that we do, we're starting to see all of those things, see them more clearly, see the effect that the past has on how we can carry out our life in the present moment. And once we start to see how things from the past or things that we're carrying with us are affecting our present moment experience, then we can do something about them. Do something with them so that we start to weaken those tendencies which take us into misery, which prevent us from realizing the goals that we set ourselves, and those things which we need to strengthen in order to realize those goals. So for this teacher, one of the things she knew that she needed was to have some loving kindness and appreciation for herself. And to have that loving kindness so that she could look at the things that she wasn't happy about, or the things that had hurt so much that they'd just been pushed aside. It's not always that the things which have hurt us. We may look and see that there are things that we've done which have hurt and harmed others. And we may not be able to bear to see them. And so we push them aside. There are a background noise, if you like, in our mind, but we never take them out and address them front on. And because we don't do that, because we push them away continually, we keep feeding them. They don't go away. They just stay there. But they condition and affect how we experience the present moment. So our spiritual practices are much more than just trying to put a lid on things, to become what we think we should be from the outside. Our spiritual practices are designed to help us to face up to what our mind contains. And as we process those things, to bring us more and more into a state of peace, clarity, more compassion for ourselves, more compassion for others. And this is the only way that we ever come to true understanding and wisdom. It's by being able to see the dynamics of the mind and the dynamics of our life that we understand personally the truth of the Buddha's teaching. If it's always at arm's length, so to say, then we can't really claim to know for ourselves the truth of the Buddha's teaching. More and more we practice, the more we'll be astounded at how insightful and how accurate the Buddha's description of the mind and the description of experience is. The more we'll see that the Buddha truly was the master who understood to its depth the workings of our minds, not just our individual mind, but the mind of all beings. And so when we little by little put the teachings into practice and discover for ourselves that great sense of wonder, really, at the greatness and profundity of the Buddha and his enlightenment, that gives us a tremendous faith and confidence and tremendous inspiration to continue with the practice and to go even further on this path towards freedom. I mentioned that the intention that arises not free of already being conditioned. And so as we go deeper, what we see is not only the obvious conditioning that's giving rise to the obvious intentions in our daily life, but we see more deeply how our underlying tendencies are conditioned, are present, and the way that they are producing the most subtle sorts of intentions in the mind. And those very subtle sorts of intentions are always to do with survival, always to do with continuity, a way of continuing into the next moment. And one of the things which the Buddha has given us as a way of understanding how we can work with intention, even if we haven't seen to this depth within the mind, is the right intention or sammasankappa of the Noble Eightfold Path. Sammasankappa is the guidelines for the most beneficial, most wholesome sorts of intentions that we can have in the mind. And the three kinds of intention that the Buddha says are the most beneficial is the intention towards renunciation, the intention towards loving kindness, and the intention towards compassion. The intention towards renunciation requires that we keep working towards being able to surrender and give up those things which we treasure. And the things that we treasure are not just the material things, it's our views and opinions, our ideas of how things should be. And when we are focusing on our intentions and start to see there's an intention of selfishness, an intention of willfulness which is harmful, that's the real renunciation. At the point of that intention, to be able to see it as unwholesome, unskillful, and to let it go. The intention towards loving kindness. Again, we think of loving kindness always for others, but the true loving kindness starts in our own heart towards ourselves. And when we see that the impulse towards harming others, the impulse towards continuing to live in delusion is actually harmful for ourselves, then out of true loving kindness, we continue to cultivate the path even when it's not easy, even when it reveals aspects of ourselves that we don't want to see. And then intention towards compassion, the sincere wish that we and all beings may be free of suffering. And when we see clearly into our own mind and see those intentions which still have a base of selfishness, of willfulness that is not beneficial, then a sense of compassion arises because we understand that we are all caught in this mire. We're all caught in this web of delusion. We, just like others who wish to be free, are still bound by our ignorance. And instead of taking it personally that we're so stupid or so foolish, we see that this is an aspect of being born, being conscious. But we also see that we have the capacity to wake up. And so true compassion, the wish truly to be free of suffering, is fed by that willingness to do the work, to work with the difficulties, to understand and to be free, and to see that that's the work that each of us has to do. So to develop renunciation, to develop the intention of loving kindness, to develop the intention of compassion for ourselves, for our own well-being, and this is something that will spread a benefit outwards further and further towards all beings. But this gives us some guidelines for how to start to direct our intention in a direction that's going to be beneficial for ourselves first and beneficial for others. So Samma Sankappa on the Noble Eightfold Path, the right intention of renunciation, loving kindness and compassion becomes our benchmark for all the intentions that we become aware of in our own mind. Important to remember that our spiritual life is not just on the meditation cushion, it's in the whole of our life, whole of our daily activities, and that the work that we need to do is not necessarily going to be pleasant, not necessarily going to be easy, but if our intention is to wake up, then we shouldn't be discouraged that we have to take small steps, many steps, even go on some byways, but never lose sight of the real goal, the goal of ultimate freedom, which is Nibbana. So may this teaching be of benefit to all of us, and may the merit from this teaching help us all to attain Nibbana.
Arahant Samma Sambuddho Bhagava Bhutan Bhagavantan Arimadin Swathato Bhagavata Dhammo Dhammam Namasami Supatthipanno Bhagavato Sāvaka.